Welcome back to the Inside the Cross Pro Lacrosse Podcast. I'm Kyle Devitt. I am the gear and lifestyle editor. And you know what? I'm just going to say I'm the pro editor and see if anyone notices for Inside the Cross. Today, I am joined by
Chris Rosenthal, Inside Lacrosse freelance contributor and pro lacrosse analyst.
Yes, indeed. And we are here to recap week four in the MLL and the PLL for all of you listening right now. This week is my MLL week, so I will go first with the MLL weekend recap. Just two games for you guys. The first one, the Atlanta Blaze 13, the Dallas Rattlers 11. This was a game, you know, story of two halves here, and not insofar as the team that won deserved to win or the team that lost deserved to lose. It was a really promising first half offense for both teams. It was a great output. And then something happened in the second half, and it just fizzled over into a straight-up turnover fest. And I'm not quite sure what happened, but that is exactly what went down here. I want to talk about the Blaze attack real quick. I mean, I really enjoy what they are doing. You know, you got Randy Stats down there, Shane Jackson, Tommy Palasek floating in and out, just putting up huge games, having good point totals. You know, Stats was 2-4 here, game high 6 points. But for me, I think the guy that really stood out and the guy that really iced the game for the Blaze was Brian Cole running out of the midfield, just really unguardable without a slide. Pull, short stick, mismatch, doesn't matter. If he gets a head of steam or if you let him float off ball, he's going to score. He was incredible in this game. Shane Jackson with 3-1 here. Palasek with 1-1, but was very involved, especially at the end of the game, was making plays on ground balls. And again, I know I've talked about him a bunch, but rookie TJ Camizio is incredible. He and Palasek had offsetting kind of bandana do-rags hanging out of their helmets, and it was really confusing watching them because they actually move very similarly and have high numbers. Palasek wears 84 and Camizio wears 91, and obviously playing two different sides of the field, but still got them confused multiple times, probably due to the resolution of the game I was watching. But also, you know, we want to shout out Chris Madelon in net for the Blaze. 20 saves here. Really shut the door in the fourth quarter. Made a ton of stops in the last 2 minutes. Going to the Rattlers? Do I have to? The bright spot for them, Blake Boudreau. Really took it to Alex Woodall. Definitely got the better of him. You know, won 17 out of 28 draws here. Woodall only had 11. It was incredible. I thought he had a really good performance. He's starting to get his feet wet in the MLL, transitioning from Division II Merrimack, where he won a national championship in 2018. I think everything I said last week still holds true for the Rattlers, with maybe the exception of Ryan McNamara coming alive here. He got a couple key goals down the stretch to keep this game close. He finished with a hat trick. I don't know what anyone else is really doing. Jack Curran looked pretty good, floating through the middle, catching balls and finishing. But I don't know what this team that, like, I think one of the things that people don't realize about the Dallas Rattlers in particular, and we touched on this before, is, you know, they lost a lot of players to PLL. And not just a lot of players, pretty much all their starters and backups went to PLL. Like, this team is basically an expansion team at this point. You know, the most senior veterans are two D-mids. That's not a recipe for success. I thought Christian Carson Bannister played pretty well. I think he's getting better game in, game out. Finished with 11 saves, but, you know, let in 13. The Rattlers outshot the Blaze. They just took bad shots, and Madelon ate them up and made them pay. And that's pretty much the entire story of the game. The Blaze, I think, you know, we've talked about them as a title favorite but I can't consider them a contender until they get their decision-making in check. I mean, I look at this team in a tight game. You know, they're only up by two. And who's going to handle the ball? No one seemed to know. They even tried to call a defensive timeout when you can't do that off the end line. I want them to be their best version of themselves. And I think the problem with a lot of these MLL teams is they're cycling in all these young guys that don't have pro experience. They're great talents, but the pro game is different, and you need to be indoctrinated into that. And the only way you get better is to play. And I think we're going to get into that in the next game, but I know you watched a little bit of this one, Chris. Can you give me some feedback on what you saw from both these teams?
So yeah, first of all, on the Atlanta side, and I think can't really be stressed enough just how well Randy Stats is running kind of like field general duties down there. The whole attack is really thriving, you know, and they're working well together. You know, you mentioned Palasek, and, you know, Shane Jackson's just been finishing everything left and right. But what Stats is doing that I think very few attackmen can do is just kind of sort of like a post-game kind of attackman where, you know, you just generate the contact, and then, you know, inside roll for your own shot, or, you know, you can roll outside and then look for like a cross-crease feed or something like that. As far as their attack goes, I guess the easiest way to say it is he is doing what we expected him to do if given the stage to himself, kind of calling his own shots down there. And again, just what you said based on Cole's performance is another sort of thing. People wondered, what can he do with a full season of field play? Is he really getting that shot? You know, obviously abbreviated seasons in the past because of, you know, if you're coming from Maryland or you're coming from, you know, the Swarm, you're going to have a very, very small pro season. And he's thriving as well. Burying shots, you know, really tremendous backhands, you know, very difficult to cover that kind of box style on the outdoor. Now, as far as the Rattlers go, I didn't hear them mention this. You know, I saw like Jake Seau had been worked in. I thought he was starting, kind of bumped up from last week, getting more run from him. Lucas Wittenberg, did they mention him? Is he gone?
He's not available. They talked about him briefly on the broadcast, and then we're like, yep, not available for tonight's game. So it's as much information as I have is what I was given from the commentators. I think that, by the way, that's something that both leagues really need to get better at is, I don't know, having an injury list. Like, we need that. The fans need that. Everyone needs that. Maybe also, I don't know, a transactions list. We need that. Fans need that. Coaches need that. Players need that. Like, it's a pretty simple fix. I know that they want to, both these organizations are well known for their ability to overcomplicate things, but it's not that hard. It's really not. Either, like, they tried to do it on Twitter last year, but then they kept replying to their own replies. So no one saw the tweets because they're not fresh tweets. They're just replies to the other tweets.
Right.
Which, like, that's just a fundamental misunderstanding about how Twitter works and social media works in general. But hopefully they remedy that. You know, hopefully someone's listening to this podcast in some sort of position of power for both those leagues and fixes that. Probably not, because you know, there's a lot of criticism here. No one likes criticism. But you know, just a little tip, try to be more helpful, help out the fans, get more fans, have more interaction. We're gonna move on to our second ML game, and I gotta say, I was in the house for this one. Boston Cannons 18, New York Lizards 11. I thought this game was pretty even as it started out. The Cannons were throwing all sorts of different looks at the Lizards offense, and the Lizards were leaning really hard on RP3 to kind of dictate their answers, and he did for a fair amount of the game. It's just they put too much pressure on him to make something out of nothing, and their midfield was, in a word, atrocious in terms of creating their own chances. I never thought after, I mean, I guess you can say this for a lot of teams, but I don't remember a time before 2011 that the Cannons had more talent than the Lizards top to bottom, or since 2011. And it was very apparent in this game. Cannons guys were beating dudes over and over and over. And that's the one thing that Boston has cultivated. And the thing about Boston is Boston didn't really lose all that much to the PLL. And they're doing well. And that's what's going to happen here. The more talent you lose, the worse you're going to be. You can try and recoup it with rookies like the Lizards did this week. But established professional talent is what you need to win week in and week out. I just don't see the Lizards having guys with that one-on-one ability to beat people besides Pinnell and Malloy. And again, we're harping on this point. Those dudes are not meshing well. Just straight up, they're not meshing well on attack. What's more frustrating to me is that New York dressed three rookies that could have all played together on the same line and given you all the dynamism you needed. They had Jack Tighe, John DeAngelis, and Nick Spillane ready to go. But they never played those three guys together. You've got two guys from Yale who are great in that two-man game, understand where each other are on the field at all times, and another guy who can just straight-up lefty sweep and bomb. I just don't get what they were doing with the midfield offense. It's a complete mess, and the Cannons took advantage of it with quick slides, quick up-and-outs, and easy transition goals. I think the other thing, too, like just the experience of seeing an NLL game for the first time since kind of the exodus or the split was very interesting. And also, the Cannons are playing in a completely new stadium. It is nowhere near the same as it was at Harvard. I described it as, I think Chris and I were talking before the podcast, and I was like, it's a field. It's built into a park with a huge concourse, a beer garden, pop-up tents with merchandise and product showcases. It's just a totally different experience. It's much more intimate, much more visceral. You're right on top of the action. You know, a lot of stadiums like to say they're right on top of the action. You are actually, like, you can smell players from that front. That front row, you legit can. It's just kind of it's in a bad spot if you're traveling from the north. I'm just going to be honest with you. It took me 2 hours to get there and almost 2.5 to get home because I apparently am an idiot and chose the exact wrong weekend to drive to Quincy from New Hampshire because the Encore Casino opened up right off of 93 this week. And that day. So I hit about 70,000 cars at the same time, all kind of snail's pace in and out of that that bottleneck there right by the bridge. So not fun, not ideal, but once I got there, very enjoyable experience, in the press box, just kind of having fun, making jokes. It's a whole new crew in there. I think I knew like one person from the last time I was there, which is good. I mean, and they had like not just one person or two people. They had at least four people doing stats, which I think is great. I just wish that I had them in hand right away.
Sure.
I kind of just wanted access to those. Wasn't happening for me. And the live stats that they did have actually stopped working after the second quarter. But whatever, I was there. I knew what was happening in the game. I just think that it's insane to me to think that the Cannons are 3-0 and the Lizards are 0-4. And we're going to get to kind of the winless teams in professional lacrosse later on in our big question of the week. But, I mean, Chris, you saw the scoreline here. If you listen to me kind of explain the game a little bit, what were your impressions when you saw the scoreline?
So my big question coming out of this one, Lizards wise, was, well, when you were watching, did you get the impression that this was a team that was kind of tinkering with the lineup to look for a more positive outcome? Or did it feel like this was a winless team looking for who's going to be the guy you want to hang on to next year? Like, did it look like these were lineups playing for the future, or they're still trying to figure it out this year?
I mean, they're definitely still trying to figure it out. I'll give them that. Like, they didn't really capitulate. They just couldn't win the ball, couldn't hold the ball, and no one could get open. Which, guess what? That's why you're 0-4. You got RP3. He's not going to – like, you need to have people that can shoot when you have Rob Pinnell on your team, because he will pass to them. It's not Rob's fault. If you catch the ball and you rip a shot and you get saved and the ball's up and over your head before you can think. And by the way, that's what Nick Morocco does for Boston. Played really well. I thought it was insane watching the game that they put James Leary, graduated from UVM last year. They put him on Pinnell. And it was his first game.
Wow.
And I went, what are you doing? I even asked Coach Quirk after the game, hey, that was insane. Why'd you do that? And his answer was, we just wanted to throw everything we could at Rob. You know, we want to, like, it's not crazy to be like, we just wanted to mess with Rob. I mean, sorry. And you know, small anecdote, I definitely walked past Rob as he went to the locker room. He did not look pleased. So
didn't seem happy.
Didn't even raise my hand for a what up. Just kind of put my hat down and kept walking, because it's not a dude you wanted to disturb on his way to the locker room. You never know what's going on in there. But yeah, they're definitely, it's not like they're not trying, but the things they're trying aren't working. You need new combos. Kevin Crowley coming out of the midfield, they're covering him with short sticks, and then they're sending a quick double to his back every time. So you can't feed him anything unless he's too far away for a step down. He's not going to get inside anymore. The Cannons did a really good job of plugging that inside low crease area. The Lizards got no goals and no looks from there unless they were driving and diving. Dil Malloy actually had a really great behind the back as well. But I think you've got, you know, a war for the ball. And you can't have a war for the ball with Rob Pinnell. Give him a ball, get out of the way, catch the ball and shoot and score, and you'll be fine. They're just not doing it. It's just not happening for them. And on the other side of the ball, the Cannons seem to be able to initiate with any single person that wanted to. Tim Edwards had 2 assists in like the first quarter. Who is Tim Edwards?
It's a good follow-up question.
Right? I actually yelled that in the press box. Who is that? And then they told me, and I was like, now who is that though? I don't know who that is. Sorry, Tim Edwards. No shots. You play great. It's just one of those things where I think the one interesting thing about MLL, and I think, you know, we had a little Twitter interaction before we started recording. And one of the questions was, are there guys in PLL that you think should be playing that aren't playing? And I'm like, no. But in MLL, I think a lot of guys are getting a lot of chances that they would have never got if PLL didn't exist. And I think that's cool, because you're seeing a lot of guys take advantage of that opportunity. You're seeing some guys fail miserably, but you're seeing a lot more guys take advantage of it and push for more playing time and their role on the team. And I think that Boston has, like I said, more talent than I can remember them having since 2011 when they won the title. So that's definitely something to watch going forward. But yeah, they just ended up steamrolling this Lizards team, and that was it. They're 3-0. I'm kind of shocked, and I think they're 3-0 for the first time in the history of the franchise. So that's an accomplishment. Any other thoughts before we move on?
Yeah, so when I was just kind of checking Twitter leading up to this game, I guess right before the weekend, I saw, I wish I could find it, I'd go retweet, I'll see if I can still find it. It was kind of like a promotion for this game, and it was billed as David versus Goliath.
What? Who's who? Yeah. Who's who? Wait, I need to know.
The Boston, you know, undefeated Cannons going against the scrappy underdog Lizards.
Were they Goliath?
Yeah, man.
Who did they use for Goliath?
I don't know.
Quick,
don't
know quick, name the like, biggest player on the Cannons. Go.
No, it wasn't like a direct, it was like, you know, just a picture of the game that was going to take place. It wasn't like they
had, all right,
you know, one guy from each team. But still, just the sentiment and just like, you know, life coming at you fast of just like, yeah, you know, the Lizards, hopefully they can, you know, put everything together and execute a game plan that can finally knock down the Cannons. This is the world in which we live right now.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, it's different. We're definitely getting different storylines. I'll tell you that right now. We got different teams, and that's most likely due to the PLO, which we will transition to. But first, I want to announce we have a special guest joining us for the PLL section, and that is Inside the Crosses, Patrick McEwen, coming up in a few seconds. As promised, Patrick McEwen has joined the Inside the Cross Pro Lacrosse podcast to discuss the PLL with Chris Rosenthal. Pat, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. Any day after you get to watch some lacrosse in person is always a good Monday.
It definitely is. Chris, why don't you tell us all about what happened in the PLL this past weekend?
All right, first game we're going to start with, Redwoods 13, Chrome 11. Obviously, the main event headline from this game, Jules Hennenberg, fresh off the trade, the only trade, the biggest, of course, shows up for the Redwoods and absolutely goes off. 5 goals, 3 assists, new PLL record for points in a game, just in his first time with his new team after not seeing his abilities used to the fullest with his old squad. He comes over and really establishes a nice role for himself in this offense. Patrick, let me throw it over to you right away. What did you see this weekend with Jules Hennenberg that made things click so well for him? Or do you think it was partially just kind of a luck of the draw, first lucky first game?
No, so this is talking to some guys afterwards around the Redwoods. So Jules Hennenberg is kind of, he's not used to being a guy that coaches, like, you tell him to come get the ball and go score right away the first thing on a possession. And in this game, the Redwoods kind of were kind of like, you know, Jules, come get the ball. Like, that's what we traded you for. Like, go get it and go score. And he was like, you know, that's not really what he's used to. Kind of at Rutgers, their plan was always run something else, and then if the shot clock comes on and nobody can score, then get in the ball. And, you know, with 20 seconds left, the shot clock, okay, Jules, do something. And so I think that we've kind of seen, we saw more scoring sort of by design of that's what the Redwoods coaches traded for him to come do.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Chrome have been having these heartbreaking one-goal losses. This time a 2-goal loss. Notably absent this week was Joel White. How much of a difference do you think that made? You know, we've seen Joel White playing alongside John Galloway for all of these years, kind of a security blanket for him in various aspects of the game. Is it fair to even speculate that he could have been a difference maker in a game this close?
Well, I think in a game that's that close, one play can make the difference. So, sort of, but it's also, there's so many things that could have made a difference. I'm not sure that you can isolate him as the guy that would have made a difference.
Absolutely. Now, as far as the rest of his teammates, I think the Chrome, we're still kind of cursed by what has been bothering them earlier this season, just an inability to tighten up. And especially this kind of a pace of play. You have so many opportunities to rebound if you are making mistakes, but conversely, you have so many opportunities to, say, throw a ball away in a transition situation. Again with the Chrome, I know a lot of teams have been having problems with this, but maybe it sticks out more because of their record. Little things like offsides calls keep burning these guys, and you know they had one with the ball, they had one without the ball, it cost them, you know, in the penalty. It's just things like that, you know, in a league this close, you know, everyone just talk about how close these rosters are as far as talent level goes. These things can really kind of disrupt them and keep them from actually getting these wins. Conversely, Redwoods defense, I thought, was very solid. I thought the Redwoods defense particularly had the most fun of any close defense I've seen this season. They worked together very well. They looked very loose, especially in their transition into offense. Just the whole sort of Notre Dame triangle of defense, I thought, especially well together. But since we were talking about Notre Dame, we saw bit more activity from Ryder Garnsey this week. I think they kind of have been juggling four attackmen. He's kind of the fourth one with Clark Peterson as well. How do you feel like Ryder Garnsey fit into that system?
So this is one of my takes. I have a Ryder Garnsey take, is that I feel like Ryder Garnsey is a lot like Kyrie Irving, in that Kyrie was so much better with LeBron when it was LeBron's team. And Kyrie could kind of just go out there and do his thing. But, like, it was always LeBron's team, and kind of responsibility relied on LeBron. And I feel like Ryder Garnsey is the same way. That on this team, when he is, like, that guy off the bench, you know, for half the game at attack, he can kind of just go out there and do Ryder Garnsey things when he feels like it. But ultimately, you know, this is a team that runs through other guys, Jules Hennenberg now, Matt Kavanaugh. It's kind of their team offensively. And so Ryder Garnsey doesn't have kind of that same offensive responsibility that he did sort of as the number one guy for Notre Dame.
Absolutely. And I think the last thing I want to say about this game is Tim Trautner, not a ton of saves, which I think kind of speaks towards the Redwoods defense. But, you know, they say he finished with 13 saves, but several of them during crucial times, preserving a one goal lead. You know, he blocks a 2-point attempt from Tuttle. He had an assist early on in the game. And I think that's probably one of the attributes of his game that, if you weren't especially familiar with, say, a high point goalie, you may not have been aware of the things he does outside of just saving shots. You know, he can run a little bit. You know, like we saw in the assist, pick off some passes and go for ground balls and just kind of a multidimensional goalie.
That reminds me of one of my in-person observations. The things he does other than playing goalie, more than anybody, with that shortened field, he is 10 yards outside the crease when the ball's out in the field, and he is yelling things at their offense. When they have an edge coming out of the box, the guy who's yelling that they have a step is Tim Trautner.
Huh. That's incredible.
He's quarterbacking not only the defense, he's quarterbacking the offense from the other side of the field.
That is amazing, especially for a rookie stepping into this sort of a lineup.
Yeah, I thought it was, it's one of those things of, like, I've watched a lot of lacrosse games in person. You pick up on a lot of, like, little things like that. But I don't think I have ever seen a goalie out yelling out things about the sub game in transition when the ball's on the other side of the field.
Yeah, I have to say that would be new to me as well. Was there anything else you noticed about this game before we move on to the next?
Yeah. So we got to talk. The box score has Garrett Eppel listed with a goal, 10 ground balls, and 7 caused turnovers.
Is there some skepticism about that number?
No, I did not stat this game myself, but that is an amazing number of ground balls and caused turnovers. And keep in mind, so this is they have him with that for this one game, not for the season.
Yeah, I would have to go back and check on some notes for that. Just looking on my kind of shorthand notes during the game.
And so we got do you know how many PLL players have 7 caused turnovers on the season?
How many?
2, Garrett Eppel and Scott Ratliff.
That does not bode well for the legitimacy of that statistic.
So, which I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying that's I just feel like we can't talk about this game and not mention that if he really, like, that's an amazing box score stat, if that is indeed the case, because it's one of those, like, Garrett Eppel certainly had a great game and had numerous ground balls and caused turnovers. I am skeptical that it was 10-7, but we can't talk about the game and not discuss that in the chance that it actually was the case.
Yeah, definitely. I especially noted that he was very good at picking passes off and knocking passes down. Redwood's defense, I think, is especially good at, you know, if you're trying a cross field, skip passes and things like that, very good at getting the sticks in the way and knocking those down.
Because they have Eddie Glazer.
Yeah.
The air traffic controller.
Yeah, they were, like I said, they were the most fun. I really like the defensive combinations that all of these teams trot out. You know, they'll have their own personalities or whatever, but I really especially enjoyed watching the Redwoods defense this week.
It was cool, and you know how potentially perhaps inspiring some of that play. Jerry Byrne was in the house.
How about that? I did not know that.
Yeah, which the Notre Dame defensive coordinator was in town, presumably recruiting, and came up to see a bunch of his guys at this game. So if there's a little bit of extra Notre Dame defensive magic in the air, you know who brought it.
That makes sense. So let's move on to the night game. I guess it's fair to call this the main event. It was certainly sort of built that way. You know, you had the Whipsnakes Atlas, Maryland versus Hopkins, kind of feel to it, had the under the lights, very big environment for that one. Whipsnakes have been rolling all season. It continues this one, Whipsnakes 15, Atlas 10. Their first regulation win. They don't go to overtime this time. Strong performance kind of all around, but especially from their attack. Ben Reeves finished with a goal and three assists, almost like a quiet goal and three assists. Brian Drenner, three goals and an assist. And then Matt Rambo, three goals and an assist as well. I think personally Rambo's 3-1 stood out the most because he was the recipient of the Tucker Durkin matchup, but still found a way to thrive even with all that physical contact and, you know, solid play we expect from Tucker Durkin. And then Drenner kind of got his later on. But as far as the whole Rambo-Durkin matchup, how did you see that playing out?
Like, he's just a bowling ball of a dodging attackman. And I agree that of his 4 points, his definitely stood out the most. Kind of just the way I think he's doing the most to create them of those attackmen.
Yeah, and I would say another thing about his game, just as far as his dodging goes, I noticed that he kind of ended up in a position where he could drop, say, I don't remember the number, it was probably about 4 roll dodges, and he eventually had Tucker Durkin chasing him overhead. Now, this is, I believe, the second week in a row Matt Rambo has scored going against a defenseman who ended up having to go for an over-the-head check. And that seems like something that is really just evidence of someone who is very, very strong when it comes to quick movements, more so than, you know, you look at Matt Rambo and you're thinking, okay, you know, he's probably going to drop a shoulder, he's probably going to, you know, post up, back you in. It's like, no, but this guy has, you know, like splits and rolls, and has the agility that he's using to get position on these guys. It's not just the physical. Obviously, he does a great deal with the physical, but he has a tremendous amount of agility as well.
Oh, yeah, for sure. No, he is a complete attackman in that sense. And, yeah, people, I'm certainly guilty of it. Yeah, you make too much out of kind of his ability to lower his shoulder into guys to create space. And it's also what he does with that space. There are, you know, a lot of guys who can lower their shoulder into somebody, but then what do you do with the separation you create when they take a step back to get their hands on you?
Yeah, definitely.
And Matt Rambo was certainly able to use that space, set up rolls, and to get his hands free.
And, you know, the Witch Snakes did win, but it wasn't easy. They didn't, you know, steamroll the Atlas. They were actually trailing for a significant portion of the game.
Well, and, yeah, and then the steamroller came out, and they just rolled. It all happened. It was one of those. So people have talked to the PLL about the weird kind of atmosphere that the lack of a home team creates. And that was, at least in when I, it was so evident for me in this game that you just, like, the run just happened so fast and just flipped everything around. And it's the lack of a home team that fans are cheering for, or like that they're not in sections in the stands. Like, if this was a real Hopkins Maryland game, you'd have somewhere the Hopkins section and the Maryland section, and the cheers and silence, you know, would help kind of orient you to the path of this game. And the run, and just that every goal kind of gets applause from the crowd, it almost disguises the run in this game.
So did it feel like, kind of based on what you were saying, did it feel like everyone was just cheering for lacrosse in general?
There are definitely times where it does, but it's one of those, it's in some ways almost hard to keep track of if there are different people, because especially with all the number of Baltimore connections of these players, you, I'm sure, had some people who were there rooting for players on both teams because of, you know, who they, you know, they know people's family members, or they played with somebody's brother or somewhere in high school and that sort of thing. More potentially than the teams even.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It is kind of a, I don't know if turf war is the right sort of word. It's a, I don't know if it's a Montagues and Capulets. It's some sort of weird mix when you have all of these little groups in Baltimore all kind of squaring off in one place at one time like this. Strange allegiances, I guess the easiest way to put that. Before we go any further, I do have to say, in this game, a couple highlights for me. Trevor Baptiste with a two-pointer. Kind of a questionable setup. I think Joe Nardella thought he was maybe incorrectly called on some sort of violation. Quick whistle, but credit to Kyle Hartzell for moving as soon as the whistle went on that one.
And credit to Baptiste to catch and rip it with a face-off head. You know.
Right. There's confidence. There's absolute confidence that it takes.
And carry that shot against a PLL goalie.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, if that's saved, then that's basically almost like declining a penalty.
Well, what's going to happen then is Nardello's going to beat him to the box, and there's going to be transition the other way.
Absolutely. And, so that gave him a two-goal lead, but the lead not hold, largely thanks to Ryan Drenner, who are we're obligated to, and it is an honor to constantly shout out on this podcast. Once again, well done. Gamesmanship by him, after a Ben Reeves goal, looks like Jack and Cannon kind of maybe felt like Drenner was too close to him, pushed him over and got the penalty. Cannon perhaps exceptionally strong, or maybe Drenner helped him a little bit in selling that call. Who's to know either way? But that kind of added to it.
Because then you had that, and then the dead ball foul gave them the ball on man up.
Right. Yeah. So it all kind of spiraled out of control. You know, they look up and another two pointer goes in, and all of a sudden it's 15-9. And then, you know, they caught back, made it 15-10, but that was game. We kind of get into this a little bit, but as someone who was there, I wanted to ask you, did this feel like the game of the week? It wasn't as close at the end as the other ones, but just based on the crowd and the evening aspect of it, did that feel like the game of the week for you?
Oh, no doubt. Between the night game and the crowd and just everything, it's one of those that, because of the atmosphere, the close games are exciting, but honestly, I lose track of the score more than at any other lacrosse games that I've ever been in.
Yeah, that makes sense. I can see that. It's almost like I guess to compare to another sport, you know, you can look up in a basketball game and feel like, you know, what exactly is this, you know, trading the baskets, trading the goals. You kind of have to get a moment where you catch your breath and look up and see what the actual status of the game is.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I think it's because of the lack of home teams. I think it messes with the calibration of my brain in how I like follow the game.
Gotcha.
That I feel like makes the score, it makes the score not matter as much because people aren't there hanging on the outcome of the game, rooting, you know, with a strong attachment for the team. Means that, like, you'd like the game to be close, but, like, I don't know, I never felt the same drama, I sort of think that you do at some other events, with a more traditional kind of setup of teams. And I think it's one of those, it hurts them in some cases, but I think in this case, it helps them. It makes the fact that it wasn't a close game doesn't detract from the atmosphere at all.
I did want to ask you, get your thoughts kind of X and O's wise about the Atlas's use of their attackmen, because we talked in previous weeks about, you know, their offensive potential from the attack versus from the midfield and where their strengths lie. So now they had four attackmen that they were using and sending Chris Kluche and Kieran McArdle out of the box. Still scored the 10 goals, but can kind of carry this to the future and say this is something that probably worked out well for them. Well, would you agree with that? Do you think that worked out well for them? And how would you see them using that going forward?
Yeah. I feel like it's one, they have all these lefties. They don't have all these lefties. They're two lefties. I wonder, should you mix it up? Because I like when the lefties hang out on that side of the field, they're close to the box. And then when you go to the other side, I almost feel like you should do it with a righty. Because it's so they're going to end up closer to the field, so you don't have like Kluche trying to play on the wrong side of the field.
Right.
To be closer to the box or get caught on the far side. I mean, I guess you can just run off. You can still run them out of the box. But I love McArdle catching the ball and just coming right into that left-handed sweep across the top.
Yeah, that's especially difficult to it's kind of different the way that they have McArdle and Kluche, who are just pretty much dynamically opposed players. You know, you have McArdle doing that sweep like you described, and then you have Kluche, who just comes downhill when he comes out of that box. And they caught the Whip Snakes in a situation where he's just rolling out of the box, and he's faced off against a short stick, you know, oftentimes short stick offensive midfielder. If they're lucky, a defensive midfielder, but either way, they want no part of Kluche just coming at them like a freight train. So it's kind of like a thunder and lightning sort of situation where they can both take advantage of that box substitution, but in very different ways.
Yeah, and I think Atlas is a team that has kind of struggled for some midfield dodging, that guys like Connor Bucic and Paul Rabel have had their moments, but I'm not sure they've been as consistent as the Atlas would like them to be, in terms of creating and settle offense. So I think it's one of those moves you kind of do from necessity to get some extra dodging on the field.
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, when you have guys like that in the lineup, you know, it's really up to their, you know, you have to figure out how can I get these guys working. You know, you don't want to just have, you know, what are you going to do? Just sit here, McArdle all game or something like that? And they got to find something that works.
I think if this is 3 or 4 years ago and we have 72 and 74 point, probably more of a 72 point season Paul Rabel on the field, I'm not sure that you want this. You want to do this move, but I think with the current the current Paul Rabil. You need that little extra juice on the offensive end, given their lineup.
Absolutely. Moving on to the next game, unless you had any final thoughts you wanted to share about this one.
Nothing about covers it for me.
All right. Final game of the weekend. Chaos versus Archers. Chaos win this one 14-13. Chaos keep rolling, looking solid, looking dangerous and frightening, especially their transition game. The thing that stood out to me in this one, and this was the first note I jotted down about this game, was the old quote that's kind of paraphrased a million times, but you've heard it to some degree. Everybody has a plan until they get popped in the mouth. And the Archers are kind of just, I at least feel that they are known for more of a meticulous nature. You know, you have Schreiber up top picking people apart with these no-look passes on man-up situations. You know, we've seen like Marcus Holman with no angle, you know, very, very precise of what they're doing. And the Chaos is, on the other hand, about transitions and, you know, behind the backs and, you know, the fakes and just, it's just a lot to take in. It is very difficult to take everything in. And I thought watching the game, that might have been what kind of knocked the Archers off balance. I felt like they came out a little bit sloppier than I expected them to. They had a lot of passes sailing over each other's heads. Things, regardless of winning or losing, we're not really used to seeing the Archers playing at that level. And I think it was because they came in, even though the plan was to, you know, we're going to hit singles, we're going to slow this thing down. I think you still get in once you actually lower into the shark tank. I think it's a little bit different. And so,
what was their plan to slow the game down?
Well, I should say, and I guess this comes from a different point, because as someone who was watching the game from television as opposed to being there in person, there was a little, I'm going to get the words a little bit mixed up, but they, you know, they went behind the scenes talking to, you know, the whole pregame with the coach discussion and, you know, here's what we're going to do, guys. And it was like, you know, okay, we have our plan. We're going to do what we do best. You know, it was that sort of a aspect instead of you know, let's go meet these guys toe-to-toe in the streets and keep swinging until somebody drops.
No, I'm sure that's the case, I guess, but watching it though, what like, it's great for the Archers coaching staff to say we're gonna slow this down, but I guess I feel like you have sort of two options. If you're trying, you either have to get your guys to the box faster, or you have to leave your midfielders on the way back to defense.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, and I'm not, I don't know, I feel like that, like, you can say you want to slow it down, but unless you, what are you doing to make that happen? You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
They're not necessarily going to push in transition if it's not there, but that doesn't mean you can stop. You have to have some kind of plan to stop the Chaos transition. And I wasn't totally sure what that plan was.
Right. And speaking of the Chaos transition, another game where we saw a lot of their poles pushing the issue and scoring some goals as well. Jared Newman had a pair of two-pointers. They just make an active effort to keep, you know, you will look up on these substitutions and they'll have two poles just hanging out down there. And, you know, the Archers got caught one time leaving the pole kind of alone to focus on, I believe it was to focus on Jake Furcaro, who was open up top.
That's what I mean, though. I think it was Troy Ray on the crease,
right?
I believe. But no, that's one of the things I want to talk about. I feel like that they did so well is in these kind of transition games, you pick up a huge advantage if you bring a close defender over the midfield line, because it allows you to send like two guys over to create a 5-on-4. Or three guys to create like a 6-on-5 and sub simultaneously. And then you leave the offensive midfielders a situation where if they match you falling over the defensive line, they're going to get out subbed, because then the close defender just goes back and the guy runs on from the box. And now you have an Omid caught at the midfield line with no, like, you know, with, or not that, like, caught on the field while the other team's already subbed, or you have to bring an attackman over. And I feel like when Newman runs over, that would be an example of how you do it, try to slow them down, is you just have your, tell your attackman to match feet with their close defenders.
Actually, so
and they just, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so the chaos did, I think I talked actually to a couple college coaches about doing it, about put your best offensive pull at close defense. And if you run 10 yards over the midfield line, you can kind of figure out, are you going to get picked up or not? And if you get picked up, run back. If not, keep running down near the trailer on the fast break, on the break.
Yeah, I would say there are certain elements of like a substitution intricacy that can really determine the wins and losses in this PLL, and especially in its infancy. You know, and I think we kind of discussed this last, we were talking about Brent Adams last week. We're talking about how you can be a good lacrosse player, but a great PLL player. If you can figure out, I don't want to say loopholes necessarily, but if you can figure out maybe the right angles to take, you know, proper shortcuts. And also, I think it just kind of, the shortened field will help promote certain abilities over certain others. But like you were saying, substitution-wise, I'm sure there are some coaching staffs that have mapped this out to a degree that others have just not quite touched on yet.
Yeah, and I think it's one of, I think it's a highlights the importance of playing offensive midfielders who you're fine, because like it's, that's one option I think you have if you're the Archers, of let your offensive midfielders get caught on defense and you take away the chaos transition. Of course, you create other problems for yourself there, but potentially doing that, but you know, that's the type of players who can do that become very valuable when you play against a team like the Chaos who want to push in transition.
Yeah, I do want to also mention, because you know, the Chaos offense obviously gets a lot of love because of the highlight reel plays. You know, we saw in this one Miles Thompson going behind the back, his back and his defender's back. You know, Connor Fields is good for one or two something mind-blowing a game. Chaos defense, I thought, played especially well. You know, we mentioned Jared Newman's two pointers, but he was also defensively, you know, knocking down passes. Matt Reese, playing very well up top. Tom Shriver was held to one even strength point in this one, which is just remarkable for somebody like Shriver. We're always used to seeing some high numbers coming out of him. There were some attackmen. You know, Marcus Holman got his 4 goals, 2 assists. Will Manny, 3 goals and 1 assist. But as much as we do mention the Chaos offense, and for good reason, or, you know, the transition, important to note when, you know, they do thrive defensively as well, especially before I forget, Blaze Reardon.
That's what I was about to say. It's real easy to look good when you have a goalie making, you know, saving 65%, making 21 saves.
Right. He had a very solid game, and he is just excellent at getting the ball out. And he's cussed. I don't know if it's chicken egg situation, but he is excellent at doing what the Chaos has been thriving in doing so far. He just gets the save and looks right away for a transition. You know, there are some plays, I was trying to jot these down as the game was going along, where, you know, he'd make a save, and then, you know, 7 seconds later, the ball's in the goal on the other end. Because they can just, you know, they have the legs to run, and they've got, especially you're playing on a field this size, your midfielder can easily make a throw from midfield to, you know, below the arc on the other side.
Yeah, that reminds me. I have two things I want to say. Is one, of course, because this is a team that is basically Albany Mighty Ducks with some other guys. Am I allowed to use Mighty Ducks as a verb?
I'd say so.
Okay. Do you know what I mean when I say that?
Yeah, I got it.
Okay. Just making sure we're clear. But I mean, he's thrown the outlets to Troy Ray and Kyle McClancy. You know?
Yeah.
that it's things that, you know, guys he's, you know, played with, go down to Connor Fields and Miles Thompson. You feel like, you know, throw a couple other guys in there. You know, of course, Brody Merrill makes it all real easy when you, you know, add him in. And then secondly, I felt like there was a play, there was a turnover that happened in midfield, and the ball ends up with an Archers player, and Will Manning's down by the goal with Johnny Cernick on him. And I think it was Marcus Holman had the ball in midfield and just immediately knows in that much space, I could just throw the ball to Will Manning and he's just gonna outrun his guy to the ball, turn and score. And I felt like that was a welcome to the league rookie moment for Johnny Cernick.
Right. Yeah, something can definitely be said for, especially for the Manny thing you just mentioned, the familiarity of him just knowing that. And like you mentioned, with Cernick just coming into this situation, you know, how does one prepare for covering Will Manny with Marcus Holman has the ball? You know, that's a poison.
Well, it's covering Will Manny in like 30 yards of space in front of the goal all by yourself. Of that you know, I on the sideline was like, oh, this is, you know, turned in sort of my spidey sense tingled of, oh, this is, you know, this is a scoring opportunity of Will Manning one-on-one in 30 yards of space against anybody. There's a chance he can find a way to get open. And he did, and I think you're right that it's just, I don't know, it's just knowing just how slippery Will Manning is off the ball, but also just, you know, knowing that this is a high alert situation of like these 5 seconds where you have to chase Will Manning all over this open space are like the 5 most important seconds of defense you're about to play.
Right.
Like, you know, this is not a relaxing moment off ball just because it's 3-on-3 and everybody has their guy, and your guy doesn't have the ball. You can't relax in that type of situation guarding a guy like Will Manning.
Right. Will Manning is very, very ninja-like in that regard. There's a silence before the action takes place, and you can't be comfortable in that silence. I would say this, since we're talking about Blaze Reardon having obviously a solid game save-wise and clear-wise, I think looking back, you know, if they're watching the film, I think the Archers might not be pleased with the shot selection either. Some of this was based on defensive slides that kind of pressured the shooting, but I feel like a lot of, you know, I feel like it wasn't their best shooting game as far as the precision goes either. That might be, again, like another aspect of the Chaos defense. And we mentioned McClancy as well. I'd say Glassini also. They had a very aggravating defensive midfield line, in the best use of the word, of course, that I think threw off some of their shooters a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think you may be onto something. I think it's some of it is... it's what you talked about before, about you have a plan until you get popped in the mouth, and your plan is to be deliberate and take good shots, and then you find yourself, you gave up, you know, a couple of 2-pointers and you're down by 6 goals, and it's hard to have that same patience and feel like these guys are running and shooting quickly, we need to do the same thing.
Yeah, I'd say so. It's tough to maintain your character when you have such an overwhelming presence like the Chaos. Before we move on, any last thoughts on this one?
No, I think that is it.
All right, excellent. Now we're going to bring Kyle back in for to wrap it up, I believe.
Hey, what's up? How'd that go, guys? You good? Feeling good?
I'd say so.
Yeah? All right. Well, one of the reasons we brought Patrick on, not only because he was at Homewood for week 4 of PLL, he is also writing a gambling column for Inside the Cross, which is new for Inside the Cross, and probably for a lot of lacrosse fans that, you know, are not used to betting on lacrosse, and we don't actually have.
Nobody is betting real money, anyways. These are all just for fun odds that I'm putting on games.
I thought that the winner of the staff picks and the who had the most money got the raise at the end. Is that not true?
That one is above my pay grade.
All right, so you're saying that's a maybe.
Well, I think right now the person who makes the determination is winning.
Right.
So he may decide to give himself a raise.
Well, that just means we all have to work against Terry, as usual. So I'm for that. Tell everybody listening a little bit more about the gambling column, and maybe not what you have going on this week. I know it's really early, and you like to work it out through the week to see what develops, but kind of recap last week and give some examples of what have gone up in the column in the last few weeks.
So this past weekend, we had two potential bets. We did, per your suggestion, over under on the number of broken shafts. You were not allowed to make a wager on that, as you were the one responsible for counting them.
And I would have won had I made the wager, but carry on.
Okay. What was it?
It was two.
How many were there?
We
set the over under at 3.5.
Yep.
As there were three the last week, and we put some odds on it. So the under, you had to give up a little bit more to win. Okay, two. Does that reverse your observation about the number of broken shafts that had been increasing, reverting to the mean?
Yeah, I think, it's in the gambling column because it's not super predictable. I think that a lot of, manufacturers and players are trying to keep up with everything because I think that, you're seeing the game played at an all-time high speed. And there's going to be casualties, and one of the casualties was shafts in the first 2 weeks in particular. So, I'm not surprised, but it definitely is reverting back to the mean for sure.
And then secondly, I put odds on the number of who would have the most face-off wins. Which of the seven face-off guys would have the most? And actually, I feel pretty good that the two guys that I put the best odds on, or I guess the worst, depending on your perspective, but the guys who I had rated as the highest chance of having the most face-off wins finished first and second. Baptiste was plus 380, finished with 16, and Thomas Kelly was first, was plus 360, finished with 15, was second.
And who won those bets? Who won those bets?
I would have to double check. Are you saying that because you did?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Well, you bet on Nardella and Baptiste.
It's called hedging, I think, right? Is that right?
That is fair. I guess you did hedge. But anyway, one thing I wanted to get your thoughts on for this week. So this week I did not put spreads and over unders on the games. I did for the third week, and one of the reasons I kind of elected to get away from that is I want to know, are the differences between these teams enough to justify making any team enough teams 1.5 or more goal favorites over others?
So I think that's going to start becoming more and more clear as the season goes on, because we're settling into rosters after week four, pretty much, barring trades. We kind of know what each team is like at this point. So I think that, obviously there are teams like the Chaos that are, dangerous and able to explode for 20 goals against probably any team in the league, right? And then you have kind of the Redwoods that are more of a defensive team that if you get dragged into the 6-on-6, that scoreline is going to be under 20, right? So I think
that's over-unders. I was asking about point spreads.
Right.
Is it worth – are you making the Chaos a 1.5 goal favorite over anybody?
Or yes.
Or the Redwoods a 1.5 goal favorite over everybody enough that becomes an interesting discussion and every game just isn't a pick-em.
Yeah, I don't think every game is a pick-em anymore. And that's kind of what I was getting at. Like, I understand that's the over-under, but I think that what you're looking at are the tendencies of the teams and the strengths of the teams versus the strengths of the other teams and then the weaknesses, right? So, I mean, you look at goal runs, like who's gone on the longest goal run? You know, who? It's not even just wins. It's tendencies and which team is better at this in this situation. You know, I think it's easy to pick out, again, the Chaos as a transition team, but I would say that the Whipsnakes are just as good, if not better, in transition at points. You know, there's, and then who can hold teams down with defensive stands? You know, what if the game becomes a 6-on-6 battle, which you see a lot with the Archers, who are more comfortable in that situation. So it's really a styles make fights kind of question. And I think it does vary week to week. And the one thing I will say is I don't think that personnel is going to shift a ton of stuff, because I think we're seeing like which players are having a lot of success and which ones aren't. And that trend is not going to change. You know, so if your favorite player has 0 points, he might end up with less than 10 points at the end of the year at this point. You know, but if your favorite player has 15 to 20 points, he's in the running for, you know, the leading goal scorer on his team for sure. So we're looking at tendencies. We're looking at strengths and weaknesses, and those will continue to develop. But I think that 4 weekends in, I should say, we have a better idea of where each team is fitting in and what kind of a team they are. And that's what you have to pay attention to, as well as the stats, as well as kind of past contests.
Okay, so we'll get, so Atlas at Archers.
Right.
Is there a favorite?
I would say Archers are definitely the favorite.
Yeah, if you're willing to take the Archers and give at least one goal to Atlas, but.
Yes, I'll do 1.5 right now.
Okay. Well, should I make it 2.5?
2.5 is too high. You said 1.5. You could do 2.5. I think people would take.
So we're in range. What about Chaos at Chrome?
I would give
That's the tricky one.
I would give Chrome 3. I would give Chaos 3.5.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. That culture needs to change.
Even though Chrome's never lost a game by more than 2.
Until Tim Sudan is on that Chrome sideline, it's 3.5.
Okay.
That was half a joke and half true, but that's how I feel.
Oh, I know. I'm not joke.
Chris, what do you think about this? Give the next matchup to Chris.
Redwoods and Whipsnakes.
So you got the Redwoods defense, which is that Whipsnake attack.
I feel like all these games just feel like a pick 'em.
Right. I would say this one definitely feels like that.
Maybe somebody is favored. Like I said, the Whipsnakes are favored, but I'm not sure if it's Redwoods. If I'm getting a goal, like if it's Redwoods plus 1.5, I'm not sure who. You know, I feel like everybody's just going to bet on the Redwoods.
I would do right. Whips. I would do Whips 1.5. That's safe.
But it's like, they've only won one game by more than a goal.
Yeah, but they could have won all their games by 5. That's the thing. Like they are the one thing the Whipsnakes have that no one else has is like absolute top to bottom team speed, team shooting, team everything. And Burnlor and Nardella are two of the most underrated players at their position in the entire sport. So I think that it's easy to like sleep on that team and say that, but just like it's also easy to say that about the Chrome. I just see the Chrome's problems are late in the game a lot. But Whipsnake's problems are also like giving up runs when they think they've already won. So that's the youthful component of that team that I wouldn't trust. But at the same time, like that firepower, I don't argue with that. You know, so for me, like, you know, we could grade all the different ways that these teams are good and bad. But there's so many things at the professional level that you have to score for multiple points and you have to make stops in a row to win games. It's actually very similar to the NBA. The flow of PLL is more like NBA basketball than anything else in lacrosse. Do you agree with that?
I certainly agree. There's a definite basketball feel in the tempo.
Yeah, I think some of it, though, is basketball sort of, I think the in terms of just feel, you need more transition in lacrosse, because in basketball, like, guys can just go down, and if, you know, it's easier just to take a quick shot when there's not numbers. In lacrosse, you sort of need numbers to generate those really quick shots, 10 to 15 seconds into a possession, you know, a couple steps over midfield and taking a shot. You really need numbers. In basketball, that can happen. You know, they called it with Steve Nash and the Suns, the 7 seconds or less offense.
Right. But don't you think there are teams in the PLL that do that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I'm saying, I just think you need it is the most basketball-like, but I'm not sure that that's like, I think some of that just conflates because of the timing. You have quick settled possessions in basketball that have the feel of uneven transition in lacrosse.
That's fair. I don't disagree.
If that makes sense, that you have, you can, you know what I mean? You in terms of sort of actual, like, from cold hard analysis, transition versus settle, I think the PLL almost seems more transition oriented than NBA a little bit, but it creates a similar feel because the court's smaller and the shot clock is quicker in the NBA. So some of those what are truly settled even possessions feel like a transition possession in lacrosse.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a one-to-one, but it's just more like the tempo is more akin to that level of that sport is really all I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's fair.
All right, one of the things that we like to do to end the podcast is we give our recommendation of the week, and Patrick, you're going to give yours, but Chris, you're going to go first. What do you got?
Do I have to give one?
Yes, you do. That is part of being on the podcast. You got to have something you like. You got to have some positivity after all the stuff we just did. So Chris is going to go first and you'll have time to think about it. I don't even have one written down, but I'll come up with something even though I'm a negative Nancy. Chris, what do you got?
Okay. First of all, I got two. Real quick one. Capital District Lacrosse. Capital District lacks all AKAs there. Recommend that the PLL sells Connor Fields jerseys. So if they don't, PLL, get on that. You are wasting opportunity and money because they would buy a lot of them. So that's for them. My personal recommendation, Marshmallow Moon Oreos. Gentlemen, as you know, this is the 50th anniversary of the United States of America's alleged moon landing.
It's not alleged. Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't turn this into a conspiracy podcast. I thought you were trying to slip that past me. It's not going to happen.
I was definitely trying to slip that by you.
Yeah.
And so anyway, shout out Stanley Kubrick. As a result, numerous companies are getting in on the celebration. You know, Krispy Kreme is selling some donuts that they're doing their thing. And anyways, lots of, I think, Dairy Queen, you name it. All stuff that's bad for you, they're finding ways to celebrate the moon landing. One of these, the good people at Oreo, put out some new products last week, I believe, Marshmallow Moon Oreos. They are regular, you know, old school cookies with space shapes on them. You got, like, stars and moons and stuff like that. purple marshmallow cream on the inside, and the packaging has like some glow in the dark stuff for, you know, for the kids and people who are big time fans of things that glow in the dark. So kind of like the Freeze Pop Skittles that I mentioned a couple weeks back, it's not a dramatic difference. If you don't like Oreos, you're not going to like these Oreos. If you do like them, you're probably going to like these just as much, maybe a little bit more than your regular old school Oreos. But so there's a tiny difference, and I will say they're worth tracking down if you like the limited edition stuff. And they are way easier to find than those Skittles. You can probably get them at your Target, Walmart, any sort of big places like that. Go grab yourself a pack and celebrate NASA, celebrate U.S. Ingenuity, the space race, and Apollo 13, and Tom Hanks. That's it.
Patrick, what do you got?
My one recommendation is I feel like Rosie needs like an Oreo review YouTube channel. Because that was an incredible review.
Thank you, sir.
Like, you ever see that one with a kid in a suit who like reviews fast food?
No, is it like a business suit?
Yeah, he's like 15. We don't need to talk about, but I feel like you could have that version of an Oreo review. It's like you just sitting at a table, like, you know, consuming the Oreo and describing the texture and the flavor for like 5 minutes. But anyways, my actual recommendation is recommend a book by a guy named Kirk Goldsberry called Sprawl Ball, which is it's a basketball analytics book about the changing geometry of the NBA, and it really, in a lot of ways, is for me, is like just a giant list of all the charts that I wish I could make for lacrosse.
I mean, you can make them.
Do you know how many like hours I've spent trying to get large quantities of shot chart data?
Yes, that's why I said my comment. Because I know that you actually can't, because no one will give you the data to do it. It's my favorite thing. Don't mess with Patrick's data. God. Everyone keeps messing with it.
I really want data. There's not enough, and I need more.
Give him all of your datas. All right.
It's like I got a fever, and the only prescription is more data.
Oh, my God. This is either the worst or best podcast we've ever done. All right, I'm going to do my recommendation. And
it's probably the worst. Like, let's be honest.
It's fine. Well, it's fine. People,
you, because you know me, but this is probably terrible, terrible for people who don't.
I mean, I laughed so hard I cried when you said you needed data. So I think it's great, and you have my support. I'm gonna go last and kind of flip it on its head. And you know, we've had a lot of fun. It's been pretty silly. I'm gonna recommend people with like grandparents. If you still have grandparents, you know, like give them a shout. My last grandparent passed away this weekend. Grandma White passed away on my mom's side. And you know, I find myself thinking like, you know, did I spend enough time with her? She had dementia and she had a lot of other problems, and she was, you know, past, 82. So it's, you know, it's, she had a good life and she lived a long time. But, you know, I think one of the things that happens when someone passes is you go back and you think about, you know, could have you spent more time with them? Could you have called them more? So my recommendation of the week is call your grandparents, man. You know, tell them you love them and tell them you appreciate them, because you never know how long they're going to be around. And on that somber note, we're going to end the week 4 Inside the Cross Pro Lacrosse podcast.
Isn't the recommendation of the week supposed to be an uplifting thought, Kyle?
It is uplifting.
Okay.
Yo, man, don't turn my grandma dying against me. I can't handle that right now. It's not cool. Don't do that. We're trying to get through this, dude. It's good. It's
like we're trying to give up.
It's good.
Trying to give up on doing segment, and you are talking about your grandmother passing away.
Yeah, and she was great. And your grandparents are probably great. So, do you have grandparents, Patrick?
I have one.
So my recommendation is that you call them. And that everyone else with a grandparent should also do that. Because it's a nice thing to do. And it's the right thing to do. And that's it. And that's what we're going to end on a totally unnecessary argument at the end of the podcast. Because that's what happens when we bring guests on. All right. Thanks for listening. We'll check you guys next week.